It doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to criticism of, we want this to be better, there's something we're missing, and you realize, you know what, I can learn from this. You have to be willing to sift through to find that.
Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa, and I have a question for you. If you wrote down the names of the people whose opinions you really care about, how many names would you have? 10, 50, 100? Brené Brown once said that the people whose opinions matter to you should fit on a post-it note. My younger self had definitely not read any Brené Brown. Young Lisa cared what a lot of her friends thought. Good friends, bad friends, casual friends, friends from classes, church friends, childhood friends, neighborhood friends, swing choir friends. Yeah, you know, swing choir was a thing in the Midwest. It was cool, okay? You're just gonna have to take my word for it. If I had listed the names of people whose opinion I cared about, it would have taken more than a post-it note. It would have taken an entire ream of paper. Now, decades later, I know that not every opinion matters. But if you're like me, sometimes you find yourself slipping into second-guessing yourself when you read that stinging comment on your socials or receive that backhanded compliment from your coworker. Navigating others' opinions is a constant challenge, regardless of our resolve, which is why I brought in a guest today who could write a book on how to do it. I'd like you to meet my friend Brandon Sanderson. Brandon is a best-selling, award-winning author that has not only created an intricate fictional universe known as The Cosmere, but he has millions of fans around the world who are devoted to its lore. In fact, when Brandon used crowdfunding for a new book, he didn't just raise enough to write a book. He raised over $41 million, cementing it as the most successful Kickstarter campaign in history. Suffice it to say, Brandon understands the power of public opinion. Brandon arrived in the studio for our interview in his signature look, a dark blazer, t-shirt, and jeans. He looked every bit the fantasy icon that he is. And when you have the world's most successful writer in the genre in your studio, you expect him to talk a lot about things that aren't real, like magic systems, fantastical creatures, and world hopping between universes. Instead, Brandon gave me a masterclass on something that is oh so very real, and that is how to navigate what other people think about us. Brandon's had to negotiate this as a writer, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, and as a believer. Today, we're going to let this storyteller tell us how he's come to terms with the audiences that matter most to him. And in listening to his story, you might just gain some inspiration for your own story. Here's Brandon Sanderson.
You know, you're the rock star, right? Like in the literary world.
Among nerds. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
I love my nerds. So I'm happy to be the king of the nerds, but yes.
It's amazing. Congratulations. I am wondering about like how you stay motivated through it all.
So it's interesting. My biggest moment of kind of crisis came before I published. So I wrote 13 novels before I sold one. I sold number 6 while I was just polishing off number 13. And my biggest crisis moment was actually between 12 and 13. And what happened to me at that point was, you know, you write 12 novels and they don't sell.
Yeah.
You got to be asking yourself some hard questions, right? Your parents are calling and being like, I always joke, my dad would call and be like, your mother's very concerned, son, which is dad speak for, I'm very concerned, son, but I don't want to insult you by saying that. And they were both very supportive as much as they could be as good Utah Pioneer stock business people.
Yeah.
You know, my mom's an accountant, my dad's a businessman,
yeah.
Right? Who are looking at the numbers that don't quite add up to their...
The numbers are telling us a story that has us concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Not us, but the numbers.
Yeah. Numbers are concerned.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, this is the time where George Martin was getting big. And George Martin is kind of my closest contemporary in epic fantasy. And, you know, he writes very grim work. George loves the kind of classical medievalist fantasy. And that's what people were looking for. They were not buying my brand of lots of magic, kind of optimistic fantasy during that time because the industry was looking at what George was doing. So I'm getting rejection letter after rejection letter. I'm not selling. It's been 10 years. I'm finishing a graduate program, and I only went into the graduate program to stall, right? Because you can't do anything with a master's in creative writing.
don't tell me that.
What?
Don't say that.
You can't. You either have to have an MFA.
Yeah.
Or you have to have a PhD to teach. And it's like, what am I doing? And I looked and took a long, hard look at what I was doing. And I'm like, this is what I am. This is what I've built my identity around. This is what I love to do. If I have to get a real job and I have to, you know, write as a hobby, I'll be okay with that, right? Like, telling the stories is what I want to do. Will I prefer it? No. But I am a bigger success if I die at, you know, age 100 with 100 unpublished novels than if I just give up on this thing that I love. And I made that decision during the hard years before money was coming in and things like that, and just decided I'm going to do this. This is what I do. And then that's when I sat down and I wrote the first draft of The Way of Kings, which is one of my most successful books. That's the book that I wrote having made that decision. Yeah. So when you ask what motivates me, it's the stories. I can look back and I confidently know that I would have kept on writing books if I'd never sold one. Even if you would come to me and say, you know what, you're never going to sell a novel, mm-hmm. I would still be writing them.
Do you remember a moment where you thought, yeah, I'm a successful writer?
You know, it comes in steps. So when I broke in, for a while, you consider yourself the new kid who's making a name for himself, right?
Yeah.
And your main work is to get people to hear about you, right? Like, your enemy is just the mass amount of noise that's out there. At about 10 years after I'd broken in, I realized I am now the established pro that people are responding against. I can't be the new kid anymore. I can't, my self-image can't be this scrappy underdog, because I'm now one of the best-selling authors in the genre. And that switch was very odd for me because I'd spent 10 years as the scrappy underdog, right? And I think that's the moment where I said, okay, I think I'll be okay. Because you never really do know.
Yeah, especially in the creative arts.
Yeah.
When people say, oh, you're successful. And obviously there's New York Times best-selling, you know, right. There's other metrics. Mm-hmm. How do you define it?
My definition of successful as an artist is being able to make a living at my art and continue doing so. Everything else is gravy. I often say, if you would have come to me the year my first book came out and said, you can lock in right now at 50 grand a year plus inflation and guaranteed you're going to make that for the rest of your life, would you take it? I would have snapped it off. And they would have said, no more. You can never earn more than that. But you'll be guaranteed this, I would have taken it. Because can live on that, right?
Yeah.
Knowing that I could continue to write my books and have an audience would have been enough for me.
Oh, I love that.
Now, it's gone very different places from
yes,
that.
Yes, it has.
But that's success to me as an artist.
I just want to stop here for a minute and point to a few things Brandon said. The first is that the voice Brandon has listened to more than any other for the past 20 years plus of his career has been his own. His own. He wanted to tell stories, so he wrote and wrote and wrote. And it didn't matter if he ever sold any of the books. He loved the stories and wanted to pursue his passion. Now, I'm going to say I'm not going to give up my day job to pursue a career in 80s British rock band concerts just because I have a passion for them. But what I am saying is that we often prioritize what other people think about us over what we think of ourselves. Brandon's ability to prioritize his own voice, even when books weren't selling, took a lot of courage. And don't you just love a good underdog story? Author defies the odds and becomes a bestseller again and again and again. Yes, it took imagination and talent and dedication. But I also think Brandon's decision to listen to himself is a huge part of this happy ending. Now that Brandon has established himself as a household name in the world of fantasy, he no longer has to battle doubt. Instead, he now has to deal with criticism.
So criticism falls into a lot of different camps. And putting it all just as one is not very helpful because there's a lot of very legitimate criticism, right? And trying to pierce through criticism requires looking at who is criticizing because they love this work and there was something they were wanting they didn't get. Do you want to give that to them? I generally watch trends of criticism, right? Not individual. Once in a while, you'll get something and the trend of criticism about a book, you'll be like, you know what? You guys were right. I'll look at that and that's something I should be aware of. Sometimes it's, haha, you're reacting as I want you to. You're disappointed by something because that's an emotion that sometimes we want. Very rarely do you want disappointment, but sometimes you want a certain sort of unsettlement to a story. Sometimes the criticism is, I don't like this style of story, ergo it should be like the style of story I want. That's not very useful criticism, right? And sometimes it's just like, I don't like this person's dominance in the market, which is totally understandable, right? A lot of the criticism you get once you become one of the top sellers is people responding against it. Right? Mm-hmm. And they want to be like, oh, it's not that good for this reason, this reason, this reason. And that's understandable, but that can be the most destructive if you pay attention to it, right? Because what you're doing intentionally and what you've built, it's a very natural thing, particularly on the internet, to try to tear that down because it's very fun to break things.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never heard it like described that way, but you're right. That's why people do it.
What
right?
does every kid want to do when they see a cool tower built out of blocks?
Oh, yeah.
I've got three little boys, and one could not build a tower without another coming by and seeing how much fun it is to knock things down. That even makes the critics sound too malicious about it. Some of them are. Most of them, it's just like, I don't get this. I do think there is this danger in the modern era that we are very fault-finding because it's entertaining. That's dangerous just because we're always looking then to knock things down. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to criticism because that first group of, we want this to be better, there's something we're missing, and you realize, you know what, I can learn from this. You have to be willing to sift through to find that.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't let the last group destroy you. And so you can't just call all critics haters, but you also can't take all feedback. So there's a whole lot going on in that, and it's definitely more art than science, figuring out which ones you listen to and which ones you don't.
Success is tricky, as Brandon can attest. Because as soon as he became a well-known author, he also became a target for critique. But luckily, Brandon has drilled down to some pretty important truths about criticism. First, we should pay attention to trends instead of individual comments. If there is something to learn in the trends that we see, then we can embrace it if we choose. But when it comes to people who just want to tear us down out of insecurity or a desire to be entertained, don't give them the time of day. That's not feedback we need to waste our time on. Brandon has managed to find that fine balance. Brandon has also figured out how to achieve a balance at home that works for him and his family. It may not look conventional, but it works for them.
Your writing schedule is legendary, and I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about it.
I mean, it's boring. Other than I didn't become a writer to do a desk job or to get up at normal hours. So I tend to these days get up around 1, and I tend to work from about 1 until 6, and then I hang out with my family from 6 until around 10. Then I go back to work from about 10 until 2. And then I goof off from about 2 until 4, go to bed at 4, sleep by 5. And that's a very regular schedule for me. It means I get to get up whenever I kind of feel like it, but I tend to be pretty good at scheduling and pretty self-motivated. That schedule could be very bad for other people who have different brain chemistry and psychology from me. I am blessed in that I tend to do very well at keeping a schedule on my own, working from home and working and seeing the progress. I always say that my biggest motivation is seeing the progress count up. Keeping track of the percentages I'm done on a book and watching the numbers go higher is very motivating for me. And so that's really handy when you have to work on your own and a book that you start working on now, you know, you're going to release in 4 years, right? I'm working on one now that'll be out in 3.5 years. And You have to be working a little bit on it every day for all of those years for it to come out. There's no deadline but the ones that I set. And having a good schedule is really important for accomplishing things across large periods of time when you have no manager watching over your shoulder, right?
And being like, oh, you need those pages done. Yeah. And Are you ever tempted to leave things to the last minute, or have you done that before? And
I'm pretty good at not doing that. If I'm leaving something last minute, it's because it's something I don't like. The things that I don't like, I will often leave because I will find things that I like to do more. And fortunately, the writing is something that I really like.
Yeah.
But you can't procrastinate writing a 400,000-word novel, right? Like, you can write, a lot of writers, 2,000 to 4,000 words a day. 4,000 is very high-end for a lot of writers. We're really looking at 2,000 to 3,000 a day. And that's, you know, 100 plus days in the chair just for the rough draft for a book that length. You can't do that last minute, because then you need a year of revisions and things like that. So it is very good for everyone that I am very slow and steady in my progress.
Yeah. How do you manage the balance of work and a home life?
Right. Yeah. So this is one of those things that early in my marriage with Emily, we had to figure some things out. Because if anyone's out there is married an artist, and it's not just artists, there's a lot of jobs like this that don't leave you when you leave work. And for writing, you often need to be thinking about what you're going to write the next day. It's like when you sit down for a writing session, I often liken it to how you draw the water out of the well. It's that old metaphor, but then there's water that's in the stone that's going to seep in and refill the well. And so you spend a few hours writing, and that seeping in is the time in between that your subconscious is working on what you're going to do next, and then you sit down for another writing session. And one of the ways that I got set in is time when I wasn't writing was still time for writing. And then I get married, and I'm not always there for my wife when I'm there with her physically, right? You're driving somewhere, and I'm like, ooh, driving is time to be thinking about a book. And meanwhile, she's like, driving is great time for us to chat together and decompress about our days. And I had to realize that I needed to be making time during those hours that I was there physically with the family, and made a rule for myself that 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock time is not writing time. I had to take it off of the plate, so to speak. At any moment, I could be working. And suddenly, you can have this problem where you start to realize that any hour could be earning you money. And so, do you do things that you enjoy, or do you spend that time building the career? And early in my writing career, like, I needed to be doing a lot more building of the career. But I had to fence off this area and be like, I can't be writing during this area. It's not an option. Even if Emily's not there, it can't be an option. Because if it is, then when she is there, I'll be like, oh, I should be doing this other thing. And making a habit out of that was really helpful for mental health, emotional health, relationship health, everybody's health, being there for your family. Like, what are you going to write about if you don't have relationships? Like, why are you writing if you don't have relationships?
Yeah.
You read about writers. Writers often have terrible family lives. And I think this is part of the reason why, is you have to work to actually be present for people. And I'm glad that we had those conversations. Emily was very helpful in me figuring this out early in our relationship, so that when my kids came along, I have been there, I hope. We'll see what they say.
Right.
But I feel like being there with them when they were younger was a very big help. Now they can beat me at Halo. They don't need me anymore.
Oh, it's a new stage of parenting.
Oh, man.
It's rough.
they have outgrown me in video games. And now they'll play with Dad when Dad wants to play, but Dad doesn't know the games they know anymore. And so they all go off and play their games.
Do you have some strategies that you have employed to be present or to maintain a good schedule like that, or a balance?
Yeah, you know, a lot of these come from my wife, Emily. Uh-huh. Emily's the one who reads on relationships. She reads fiction too. She reads everything. If there's a question, she tackles it by reading 17 books and 300 articles about it, right?
I like Emily.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's impressive. I like to do that too. I'm like, oh, we're going to solve this.
Right.
Yeah.
And she comes up with strategies. She passes along, and some of them are really good. One of them is simply turning towards someone instead of away. When someone walks in the room, take the phone, close it, and put it down. there's just a body language and thing that says, I am turning towards you. And then when you say, how was your day? There's this, like, even if somebody doesn't notice it consciously, unconsciously, they have noticed that whatever you were doing, your attention is now on them. Doing things like that, like making a conscious effort to close it and look. And when you ask that question, like, that your attention is there. And have a date night. We don't do Fridays because Fridays are miserable to go to a lot of restaurants.
Yeah,
we do a different date night, but we do it, you know, we've done it since before we had kids and all along with the kids. And it's hard when you have kids that are young, right? Making that effort to just get out of the house once a week, really important. Doing things one-on-one with your kids that they want to do. What one of my kids wants to do is show me the things that he has drawn and then talk at length about the video game that he's developed for them. And you just want to be there and nodding and ask to see the next one, right?
Yeah.
Be there and don't be, like, I'm not one of these that's totally down on phones, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's lots of ways you can communicate with people via social media that are really great, that have opportunities. You need to be looking at people. Even if eye contact is not your thing, showing that your attention is there for them will be noticed, even if it is subconscious.
It's so true. People do notice. They notice, you know, if you are paying attention to them, if you're leaning in, if you remember what they say, that kind of presence. I do love that.
Emily's really good at remembering people's names. She was a school teacher for many years. And so someone will introduce themselves and she'll say goodbye and by name. Even just like she's
got a great skill.
And man, people notice that.
Yeah. They feel loved. They feel sort of nurtured and through that.
Yep. But there are people out there that are very good at keeping people connected, and that's what they do. But for me, I found like if I wanted to see my friends consistently, I had to put them in a writing group so that I was going and seeing them every week, right? We had a reason to be there. Emily was worried about this early in our marriage, and this is one thing I was able to offer her. I said, start a book club with your former roommates that you want to be seeing. And she did, and it's still going. And they often don't even read the book.
Yeah.
The book club is just so that on the schedule, once a month, they get together and then sit and talk about their lives and sometimes about a book they may or may not have read. And getting things on the schedule and making them regular, we are creatures of habit.
While Brandon may have to sift through the comments of critics to decide which ones are worth listening to, I think it's pretty obvious that Brandon has an audience that will always get his attention, and that's his family. Brandon clearly cares about what his wife and kids think, so he makes time with them a priority. I also love his advice of turning to the people we care about, putting down the phone, making eye contact, and giving them our attention. And a good rule for relationships, regardless of which universe we live in, is to schedule our time with them, with our kids, with our spouse, and with our friends. Wasn't it Stephen Covey who said, the key is not to prioritize what's on your schedule, but to schedule your priorities? So invest in your family and closest relationships by putting them on the calendar first. Finally, Brandon has some beautiful thoughts about the role faith has played in his career.
It plays quite a big role in my life. It is a huge part of who I am and a huge part of my life and has been since I was young. How does it affect my writing? We can divide it up into different ways. How does it affect my life? How does it affect my writing? I look at the big... So Tolkien and C.S. Lewis are two of the founders of my genre, both deeply religious men. For those who don't know, Tolkien converted C.S. Lewis. And people think of C.S. Lewis as this great Christian theologian, which he was, and Tolkien was his inroads to being Christian. He dedicated Screwtape letters to Tolkien. They had numerous disagreements, one being whether you should be Catholic or Protestant. That's a pretty big disagreement that they definitely had. Another was the role of allegory in fiction. If you've read any C.S. Lewis, you know what his opinion on allegory was. Tolkien is on record saying he loathes allegory. He hates when stories are there to just be a veneer on another story. But at the same time, he definitely wasn't opposed to themes, like that was deeply important to Tolkien, but not allegory. And I kind of follow the same philosophy as Tolkien. I want to write really great stories defined by me getting to understand people. That's what I'm there for, is understanding people, understanding what it means to be human. my religion plays into that, in that what I find heroic, what I find important, often is influenced by religion. People will often go to my books and be like, wow, this looks like a little piece of Mormon theology that slipped in. I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably from there. But you can do the same thing with Buddhism. You can do the same thing with a lot of things, because I read very widely. I would say that what my religion makes me do is it makes me want to understand people, and it makes me want to treat them as best I can. And that leads me to some odd places that you might not assume. If I'm going to write an atheist in one of my books, I want to write them as well as someone I would hope that someone would write a member of my faith in their book, which means that I need to treat them with respect. And even though the philosophy in many ways is diametrically opposed to mine, it means that when I'm writing about people that may not fit the rank and file members of the church, I do my best job to represent as they would want to be represented. Same way that I approach people with different neuroatypical ways of thinking, of viewing the world, and whatnot. And this, I do think, comes from my religious sort of beliefs and things like that, which is odd that being deeply religious makes me want to write an atheist better, but it does. I do want my books to make the world a better place. I don't sit and think too much on any specific message, but I think about how can I write books that will make people's lives better. So I do think about those sorts of things. How I approach a lot of things is influenced by my faith and the belief that there's something after and that there is a God watching who wants me doing certain things. And one of those is to make good on the talents that he's given me.
I love that. What a great answer. I'm wondering if I can just ask you a final question of like, what is the most flattering compliment that you've ever gotten?
One of the best compliments you can get is when someone says, I gave your book to someone else, right?
Yeah.
When sharing a book is a huge compliment. When someone comes through the line with a paperback that is worn just ragged, often they're embarrassed, but those are the books that are a huge compliment, right? You're like, that book's been loved. Like seeing that is a huge mark of respect, giving an author a book to sign that is that ragged. Hearing someone say, I stayed up way too late reading your books, so I was almost asleep in my classes the next day, you kind of feel good about that one too. But I would say above them all is I've read the book and it helped me through a hard time. It feels like I read the book, I felt seen, and it helped me to overcome similar things. That's the best one. And that's kind of the one that I strive for the most.
I love that Brandon gave us a peek at his post-it note of opinions that matter. He cares about his own opinion. It's what compelled him to be an author in the first place. He cares about the opinion of his wife and children and closest friends, which is why he makes them a priority. And he cares what God thinks of him. That's why he treats his characters, even those who are fundamentally different from him, with compassion and dignity. And why does he sit in his office every day and write 4,000 words? Because he wants to make good on the talents God has given him and hopefully help a reader that's struggling. That post-it note of Brandon's, it's a quick read. It only has 4 words on it: himself, his family, his closest friends, and God. As I've gotten older, my post-it note list has become much smaller. It's not because I care about fewer people, quite the contrary. But I've learned that I don't need to accept every piece of advice or criticism. Yes, other people's advice can be inspiring and help us craft our goals, but when people criticize me for my appearance, my personality, my life choices, etc., it often says more about them and how they feel about themselves than it does about me. Now, knowing that has made it easier for me to brush off harsh comments. I don't take on the assignment of overthinking it for the owner. I just say, that's showbiz, baby. It's not always easy to do. I am practicing, but I'm getting better at it. And like Brandon Sanderson, we all get to be the authors and editors of our own stories. And that can start with what we've written on our post-it notes.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Erica Price, with help from Becca Hurley-Lung, Blake Morse, and Kenny Mears, with music and post-production by Gracie Davis. Brandon Sanderson is a New York Times best-selling sci-fi, fantasy, and young adult author. He is also the winner of the David Gemmell Legend Award. Links to his website, as well as to our newsletter, will be in our show notes. Also, be sure to check out The Council of Moms, now available wherever you get your podcast. As always, thanks for your messages. We read them all, and thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Lisa from The Lisa Show. And if you want to hear another great show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, check out Constant Wonder. Host Marcus Smith takes you on an exhilarating journey through captivating stories of our magnificent natural world. You'll gain profound insight into different facets of our planet. Prepare to discover more about nature and perhaps even ponder your connection to Earth's wonder. Constant Wonder. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.